Well, today we're going to, this is going to be kind of a packed time here because we got a lot to finish up with. We're going to finish up with this lesson today. And of course, you see what's going on in Syria. You continue to see what happens in the Sinai Peninsula of Egypt. Egypt sent in more military to quell some militants down there. So they've got quite a bit of military in the Sinai, which, you know, it's one of those things. Just interesting to think that, you know what, this is getting even dicier as we speak. Syria, I don't know what in the world. You know, part of me thinks, is the United States the only country left in the world that gets concerned about these deaths, you know, and who else stands up? Who else is willing to do it? Not anybody else, it seems like. It's one of those things that we probably should have done much earlier. So not sure where that's going, but Syria just continues to get worse. So again, Syria on the north, Egypt on the south, Israel right in the center, and you understand why they're kind of sweating it. This Friday at sundown is Yom Kippur, the Jewish Day of Atonement. That's the most one of the most holy days on their calendar. And it's also the day that, as we saw last week, that in 1973 the Egyptians and the Assyrians attacked Israel. Just kind of wonder if history repeats itself sometime. All right, so today what I wanted to finish up with was a couple of things. Number one, the ingathering. We're going to look at a little bit about the ingathering that's been happening for the last few decades and see, does it pan out with what God has already told us. And then the last thing that I told you I wanted to kind of bring up again later is a little bit about the third temple, the different viewpoints of the third temple. Okay, so that's what we're going to try to get into today. As of the first day of the Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah, which was last September the 4th, the Israel population is a little over 8 million inhabitants, which is about the size of New York City. Okay, so just to kind of get a perspective. Out of that total population in Israel, 75% Jewish, 20% Arab, and then 4% other. So for 8 million people, 75% Jewish, and you kind of see what kind of measure the population against different places in the world. The Olim, those are the people who have returned to Israel. That's the term that they use for those who returned to Israel, the Olim. Last year alone, there's about 17,000 people who returned to Israel, 17,000 Jews that returned to Israel. Okay? So every year, mainly during the entire 1900s and even into the 2000s, every year, more and more Jews returned to Israel. God said, you know, with the ingathering, that he, no matter where they were scattered, he was going to bring them home. So you got to kind of look at this and see these statistics. World Jewish population statistics from last year. You see that Israel, this happened in May of 2006. May of 2006 was the first time that there were more Jews in Israel than any other single location in the world for 2,000 years. May of 06. So in Israel, there's right at 6 million Jews. United States, about 5.5 million. Now then, you see the precipitous drop-off down to the next one, 480,000 Jews in France and on down. So you realize that the vast majority of the Jewish people in the world are in Israel and the United States. Now then, the question always comes up, are all of these Jews going to return to Israel before God does something? No, they don't have to. There's a lot of aged Jews that they will not be able to go back. There's a lot of Jews that are secular that they don't have any interest in going back. But by and large, it's really interesting to see how many Jews have returned to Israel. And why would they do that? Why would they do that? So God's warning to them, and these are just a couple of examples. If you want more detailed information, there's a lesson out on our website called The Scattering Out and Gathering In that goes into these verses in detail. So in Deuteronomy 28, just right quick, I want to read something that he says, 28:64, then the Lord will scatter you among all nations from one end of the earth to the other. There you will worship other gods, gods of wood and stone, which neither you nor your fathers have known. Among those nations you will find no repose, no resting place for the sole of your foot. There the Lord will give you an anxious mind, eyes weary with longing, and a despairing heart. You will live in constant suspense, filled with dread both day and night. Never sure of your life. In the morning you will say, if only it were evening. In the evening, if only it were morning, because of the terror that will fill your hearts and the sights that your eyes will see. To me, it's a perfect description of the Jewish people for the last 2,000 years. No matter where they are, basically they've been persecuted. All of Europe, Russia, Germany, all of the persecutions that have gone on, all the Arab nations where they were located, persecution. United States has probably had less persecution of the Jews than anywhere else. But that's a fitting account right there. So he says, when you disobey me, he promised them, if you disobey me and you start following other gods, I'm going to scatter you from this land that I'm giving you. I'm going to scatter you to the four corners of the earth. While you're gone, the land is going to lie desolate. But he also promises in Deuteronomy 30, he said, when all these blessings and curses I've set before you come upon you and you take them to heart wherever the Lord your God disperses you among the nations, and when you and your children return to the Lord your God and obey him with all your heart and with all your soul according to everything I command you today, then the Lord your God will restore your fortunes and have compassion on you and gather you again from all the nations where he scattered you. Even if you have been banished to the most distant land under the heavens, from there the Lord your God will gather you and bring you back. He will bring you to the land that belonged to your fathers, and you will take possession of it. He will make you more prosperous and numerous than your fathers. The Lord your God will circumcise your hearts and the hearts of your descendants so that you may love him with all your heart and with all your soul and live. So he promises them, if you turn back to me, I will gather you back. Now then, does this mean that all the Jews have turned their heart back toward God? No, it doesn't. See, again, you have people that say that God is through dealing with Israel and the Jews because they didn't accept Christ and it's over and done with. But that, again, flies in the face of God's covenant, which he said was everlasting. So, all the way through the Bible, he talks about a faithful remnant. Even Paul in Romans 9, 10, and 11, he talks about a faithful remnant. And we're going to look at here in just a second. One of his verses says, so all Israel will be saved. Well, so people go, well, that means that all the Jews are going to get in scot-free. No. Paul qualifies what it takes to be called Israel. And it's a change of heart. It's from the heart. There's a lot of Jews that Paul says are from the line of Abraham, but that doesn't make you a faithful remnant. Just because we call ourselves Christian doesn't mean that we're going to stand before Christ in his glory someday. There are those that Jesus himself says, you said, Lord, Lord, but I never knew you. So just because you wear the label Christian, you got to wonder, you got to know where your heart is. The same way with the Jews. So God says, those who are faithful, I'm going to gather you back. So what we're seeing today, I believe, is God's ingathering, because there's just no other way to explain the dispersion of the Jewish people for 2,000 years, and all of a sudden, within 100 years, what we have seen in the land of Israel. This incredible ingathering. All right, so from 1948 to 2013, the word that they use, and even today, is whenever they return to Israel, they make Aliyah, A-L-I-Y-A-H. We make Aliyah, which means to go up. So no matter where you are in the world, when they return, we say, we are going up to Israel. It's just the same thing you find in the Bible, in the Old Testament, and the New Testament. Let us go up to Jerusalem. We are always going up to Jerusalem, no matter where you are in Israel, no matter where you are in the world, you're always going up to Jerusalem and going up to the temple. That's why the Jews are focused on Temple Mount, because that is where God lived. That's why they always go up to Jerusalem, because it is the highest spiritual point. That's why they go up to the temple. They make Aliyah and return to Israel by going up. So from 48 to 2013, almost 4 million Jews returned to Israel. A fourth of that was just in the 1900s after the fall of Russia. That's one of those things that are incredible to me, that Russia, that stood for over the Soviet Union for over 50 years, fell apart in less than two. Why in the world did that happen? Was it so that God could get almost a million Jews that were locked up in Russia back to home? That makes perfect sense to me. May of 2006, more Jews in Israel than any other location. This is just one of those other statistics. During the war with Lebanon, with Hezbollah mainly, in July of 2006, there were more North American immigrants to Israel than ever before in a single month. And you've got to say, okay, now wait a minute. You're leaving the safety, security, and prosperity of North America, and you're returning to Israel during one of the most dangerous times. Why? See, it doesn't make sense outside of, I'm Jewish, I've got to go home. I'm Jewish, I've got to go home. This is some information about, remember we talked about the lost tribes of Israel? Well, they're not lost. God knows exactly where every single one of them are. In 2005, the Bani Manash, the tribe of Manasseh, was found in India. There's a group of people in India that called a rabbi in Israel and said, you know what, it seems like we're doing things that are sort of Jewish. We're not sure why. We've been doing it forever, and our fathers and our grandfathers have been doing it. Well, the rabbis were sent from Israel to investigate. And they said, these people are doing very Jewish things, and they've been doing them for hundreds of years. And so they started investigating. Well, they started saying, these people are Jewish. And they found that they were from the tribe of Manasseh. And so, January 2013, the 2,000th member of the Bani Manash has returned to Israel. There's another 7,000 in India awaiting to make Aliyah. This is just phenomenal when you stop and think. What are these people doing all the way over in India? And are they Jewish? Well, that's something else that's kind of come up in the last 20 years. You know, before the mid-90s, there wasn't a really good way to find if a person's genetic makeup was what it was. You remember what happened in the mid-90s, the Human Genome Project? All of a sudden, we had the science and technology behind this to look at the genetic makeup, and you find these people are Jewish. God's marked them. They're Jewish. So that's one thing that led to this discovery. In 1985 is when this began. The Falash Mura, 130,000 descendants of the lost tribe of Dan in Ethiopia. They airlifted in 1985 and 91 some Ethiopian Jews, but then the Falash Mura started normal immigration, and it's lasted throughout 2013. Here's from the lost tribe of Dan. So we have Manasseh, we have Dan. The tribes aren't lost. God knows where his people are. And that's just absolutely miraculous to see this over and over. From North America, July of 2007. Immigration will reach a 25-year record high this year. The number of Jews moving to Israel from North America has steadily climbed in the past 5 years. And then according to Aliyah statistics provided by this organization, Number of immigrants from North America have jumped from 1,848 to 2,525 this year. Total number of immigrants from around the world has dropped significantly over the last 7 years, from 61,000 to 16. Okay? So you see this number on the decline. Why is that? Well, because it's getting to the point that probably all the Jews that are returning to Israel, that's going to be about it. Like I say, some of the elderly are not going to return. The more secular, they're probably not going to return. They're not interested. So this number is on the decline, and so you think this is probably because this is getting close to that's all there's going to be. But again, you have to wonder, and there's people right here in Amarillo that are going to make Aliyah. You think you're living in the most secure, prosperous nation in the world, and yet your desire is to return to your homeland of Israel. That's pretty powerful. And it doesn't make sense outside of biblical scripture. So again, it's amazing to think about, you see all of this, the fall of Russia, the Human Genome Project. You see all these little things that kind of keep popping up. And you do, you think, is this all a piece of God getting his people back home? I can't deny that. Sure can't. Is there any questions on in gathering? If you go back and listen to that lesson that I was telling you, it's called the Scattering Out, Gathering In. I also have a lot of statistics in there about the Israeli economic output. What has happened since 1948 in Israel? You've gone from almost zero agricultural land to one of the most agricultural exporting nations in that entire area. I can't remember their gross national output, but it's, you know, many billions of dollars just in these 60 years. It's amazing to see what has happened just since 1948. And then you look at these promises of God. You know, whenever I bring you back, this land is going to blossom. I'm going to make you more prosperous than before. You will rebuild your city. All of these things that God has been telling them for thousands of years, I think that's what exactly we have been seeing just in the last century or so. So, any questions about that? Yes, sir? Yep. That's right. What he said, and I mentioned this on one of the very first lessons, another thing that it's always been a big joke. Golda Meir said it first. She said that, you know, Moses led the Jews around this entire area for 40 years, and he brought us to the one place that doesn't have oil. And so it's always been interesting that all this area surrounding Israel is an oil-producing, exporting countries, and Israel, you know, they just haven't found much. Well, a few years ago in 2009, 10, somewhere in there, they found one of the largest deposits of natural gas offshore, off the northern shore of Israel. There's two or three pockets that they found that's up to about 30 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, which, like he says, will make Israel energy independent for the next 30 to 50 years, and they can become an energy exporting country. Now then, think about this. Think about it. What does that mean to OPEC? You have all of these Arab, huh?
They got new members.
And I'm sure they're going to let them in. You have all these Arab countries, and Israel becomes a competitor on the energy market. Oh my goodness! So, yeah, it's pretty amazing. And in fact, there's a company out of Houston that's got a large percentage of this discovery. So it's you think, okay, us Texans, we're helping them. So, okay, so this next part I told you I wanted to kind of finish up with that we had alluded to earlier in the class that I believe is important has to do with Temple Mount, because I want you to see the different viewpoints. There's also a lesson that we did before called I Will Dwell Among Them, and another lesson called Temple Mount, Gaza Strip, that are out there that kind of goes in deeper to all of this. But what I wanted to do was to kind of bring you up to date, because like last Friday, after the Muslim prayers up on Temple Mount, They started a riot. They had to call in the Israeli Jerusalem police, quell the riot. They arrested upwards of 30 different people because they were throwing rocks and stuff down on the Jewish worshipers down at the Wailing Wall. Okay, so what you're looking at here, once again, we've seen this slide before, is this is Temple Mount, about 36 acres in the old city of Jerusalem. Okay, over here to the east is Kidron Valley. Over here is the Mount of Olives. This facility here is the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock. And then this is the Wailing Wall Plaza. And this is the Western Wall, the holiest site to Judaism. All right, so again, it's all right there, right on top of each other. This is the most intensely argued about territory in the world. It has to be. It is a flashpoint. As I've said before, all of these peace talks, you can agree on borders, you can agree on refugees, you can agree on settlements, but when it comes to Jerusalem and Temple Mount, that's where the fight's going to be. The Muslims do not want to give up this area. They want the Dome of the Rock. In the Al-Aqsa Mosque, they believe that it is Muslim. The Jews say it is Temple Mount. That is exactly where Solomon built the first temple. We've seen in biblical history that's probably correct. I believe that that's probably right. That's why it's so intensely fought over. All right? Now then, what I mentioned earlier on is there seems to be, most Christians and most Jews believe there is going to be a third temple. All right, and I'll show you these verses. For us, it seems like that the timing of the third temple is tied to a phrase called the times of the Gentiles. And I'll show you why. So turn first to Daniel. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, Daniel. And I just want to give you the verses where some of these things come from. This isn't all-inclusive. There's even more that talk about the existence of a third temple, and there's a lot more to it than just this. So Daniel 7:25. Daniel is about 500 years before Christ, 550 B.C., something like that. And he has these visions while he's in Babylon. And there are several of these visions that he has that are probably near-term prophecies and long-term prophecies. Because some of the near-term prophecies probably pointed to Antiochus Epiphanes, like we saw in 167 B.C., and his occupation of the temple at that time, his desecration of the temple. But the temple wasn't destroyed. Okay, it wasn't destroyed. It was desecrated, and the Jews revolted and took the temple back and consecrated it. So some of these prophecies point to probably that time, but they weren't totally fulfilled. So we Christians believe that there is a longer-term fulfillment. Most of the Jews believe that, yes, there is a longer-term fulfillment of these prophecies also. So one of these prophecies has to do with this certain individual that's going to come along later. And it says in 7:25, he will speak against the Most High and oppress his saints and try to change the set times and the laws. The saints will be handed over to him for a time, times, and half a time. All right. We believe that that is a prophecy of one of the things that the Antichrist will do whenever he appears on the earth. He will change the set times and laws. Now then, a lot of people have talked about this, and you've heard about it, and I've mentioned it too. The Islamic Messiah that the Muslims are looking for, the Imam Mahdi, President Ahmadinejad of Iran and several other Muslim clerics, they speak of the coming of the Imam Mahdi. The Imam Mahdi is the Muslim Messiah. Now then, there is a lot of evidence, and I mean, it's amazing the description of the Imam Mahdi, how much it matches with the biblical description of the Antichrist. Now then, it makes sense that if that's who that is, why would he change the set times and the laws? If he's Muslim, he would change it to the Muslim calendar, which I've already showed you. This year is 1434 on the Muslim calendar. So he would change the Muslim calendar. How about the laws? Sharia law. All right, so you think, okay, well, that kind of adds up and makes sense. Then it says that he will speak against the Most High. Well, we know the Antichrist will claim to be God. I'll show you. The saints are handed over to him for times, half a time, 3.5 years. Well, that fits in with the Christian belief of the 7-year period of Daniel. At the 3.5-year point, something happens. And then the saints are handed over to him for 3.5 years. So it all kind of pieces together. Daniel 9:25. Daniel 9:25. No one understand this. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens. It will be rebuilt with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble. After the 62 sevens, the anointed one will be cut off and will have nothing. The people of the ruler who will come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end will come like a flood. War will continue until the end, and desolations have been decreed. He will confirm a covenant with many for 1 seven. In the middle of the seven, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering, and on a wing of the temple he will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. All right. These are the sets of verses that many Christians and Jews say there's going to be another temple. There has to be a temple for offerings and sacrifices to be occurring in. Okay? How does this temple get built? One of the thoughts is, this one who is to come will confirm a covenant with many. Does he confirm a covenant between the Jews and the Muslims to allow the rebuilding of the temple? And is it for a 7-year period? 3.5 years midpoint, something happens, he cuts off, he puts an end to sacrifice, and then are the saints turned over for 3.5 years. So that fits very well in that 7-year period. There's a lot of evidence that shows that that 69 weeks of years, so 483 years from a certain point in the Old Testament times, winds up with the week that Christ entered on the triumphal entry and was cut off, crucified. And so we as Christians can see that 69 of those weeks of years has probably been fulfilled. We look for that 7-year period that is yet to be fulfilled. That's where we come from as far as the years of tribulation. The 7-year tribulation at the midpoint begins the great tribulation. All right, so that's where all of this comes from. But it points to a temple is in existence. And in that temple, something happens at the midpoint that causes an abomination of desolation that is spoken of again. So let's look. Matthew 24. Matthew 24. Jesus is telling the disciples about what are the signs of the end of the age and of your coming. So Jesus has told them, you know, I'm coming back. And the disciples are saying, what are the signs of this end of the age? And so Matthew 24 talks about all that. But specifically, verse 14, he says, and this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. Now then, so one of the beliefs for Christianity is that God knows the last person to receive and either accept or reject the gospel. He knows the last person in history to do that. And so does Jesus mean when that happens, that sets off that 7-year period? Then Jesus says, so when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Then, he says, because when that happens, he goes on to say, there's a time of great distress that has never before occurred in the history of the world that will happen at that time. All right. So if you go back to Daniel and say that prophecy was all about Antiochus Epiphanes in 167 BC, that can't be right. The abomination of desolation was not fulfilled in 167 BC because Jesus wouldn't have referred to it again in the first century AD. All right, you understand? So we are saying that has to have happened at some point in the future. Some people say, well, that happened in 70 AD when the temple was destroyed. No, that didn't happen. There was nobody that entered the temple and claimed to be God and caused the abomination of desolation. The Romans destroyed it. So again, Jesus seems to be talking about a future temple where this is all going to happen. Then in Luke 21, this is Luke's writing of this time also. And Jesus says in verse 20, he says, when you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, you will know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those in the city get out. Let those in the country not enter the city, for this is the time of punishment in fulfillment of all that has been written. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. There will be great distress in the land and wrath against this people, the Jews. Great distress. They will fall by the sword and be taken as prisoners to all the nations. Jerusalem will be trampled on by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Okay? So we have this point in time that says all of this is going to occur until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. At what point, at which point does all this take place in the temple? Then in Romans 11:25, like I said, he refers to this also. I do not want you to be ignorant of this mystery, brother, so that you may not be conceited. Israel has experienced a hardening in part until the full number of the Gentiles has come in. And so all Israel will be saved. So again, something happens with the Jews once the fulfillment of the Gentiles has taken place. Seems to be referred to several times. And then finally, in Revelation 11, happens again. 11:1, Revelation 11:1, this is John's vision of something that happens in the future during these times of tribulation. Revelation 11:1, I was given a reed like a measuring rod and was told, go and measure what? The temple of God and the altar. Again, we believe that, well, that must point to a future temple that has to be in existence when all this is taking place. Count the worshipers there, but exclude the outer court. Do not measure it, because it has been given to the Gentiles. They will trample on the holy city for 42 months. 42 months, 3.5 years. What did we just read in Daniel? That they will be handed over for times, half a time, 3.5 years. There's a temple in existence. Luke says that it'll be trampled on by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles were fulfilled. All this seems to be pointing toward the existence of a temple that will be in control of the Gentiles for 3.5 years, at which point somebody marches into the temple and desecrates it. Well, let's look at 2 Thessalonians. Second Thessalonians 2. So just keep your finger there. 2 Thessalonians 2. All right, so the possibilities for the times of the Gentiles. Israel, the land of Israel, was ruled by Gentiles, as we saw in our history lesson, from 586 BC, whenever the Babylonians came in, until 1948 AD, foreign rulers governed the land of Israel. Israel politically took over again in 1948. Well, so that must not be the fulfillment that he's talking about. Or it would have already occurred that Israel was politically in charge of Israel, of the land. All right, so was the time of the Gentiles specifically about Jerusalem? Jerusalem was governed by Gentiles from 586 B.C. until 1967 A.D. during the Six-Day War, whenever Israel retook Jerusalem, the city. Well, that must not be the cutoff point either. But the interesting thing is, Temple Mount was ceded control back to the Muslims in 1967 for the sake of peace. So does Jerusalem in its entirety include Temple Mount? I think it does. Temple Mount has been governed by Gentiles since 70 AD. The last temple. So is all of this focused toward, again, Temple Mount and the existence of a future temple? That's what I mean. And is it all hinging on that last Gentile to hear the gospel message? Is it all hinging, is this the time of the Gentiles? And, you know, when Jesus came, he said in there, I've come first to Israel, but then he comes to the Gentiles because God's salvation has been spread through the entire world. We are in the times of the Gentiles. God's salvation has been given to the entire world. All right? Then if there's a temple that's going to be built, who builds it? That's the big question. Big question. How does this temple get built? Who builds it? Some Jews believe that the Messiah builds it. So there's a lot of Jews, especially the Orthodox Jews, that say we shouldn't be doing anything. All we should be doing is showing our faithfulness and obedience to God. He does everything else. The Messiah does that. Only when we have given our hearts totally to God and shown our faithfulness to Him will the Messiah come. In fact, it was the Orthodox Jews that fought against the creation of the state of Israel in 1948. The Orthodox Jews said we shouldn't even be setting up the nation of Israel. That's the Messiah's job. So even today they say, we do not build a temple. We don't do any of this. The Messiah will do it when he returns. And one of the verses that they use is in Zechariah. The rest of the Jews believe that, no, we build it. We build it, and our building of that, the Sanhedrin getting King David ready, the Sanhedrin having the priests ready, the groups that have all the temple implements ready, we build a temple, that's what shows our faithfulness and obedience to God. And when we do all of these things and show God that we are prepared, then the Messiah will come and enter the temple that's already there. So one of the verses is in Malachi that talks about the Messiah entering the temple. That's why the Sanhedrin says we have to have a temple already, because Elijah is coming to announce the coming of the Messiah, and he announces that to the Sanhedrin, whose office is in the temple. We have to have the temple ready for Elijah to come make that announcement. So there's two factions of Jews. We build it, or the Messiah builds it. And there's some verses in there for both directions. The Muslims say, they're in on this too. The Muslims say that when the Imam Mahdi appears, that he will battle the forces and kill the Jews and take up his rule in Jerusalem. He will rule in Jerusalem for guess how many years? Seven. That's in Muslim teaching. The Islamic Messiah will rule from Jerusalem for 7 years. Now then, it will be up to him whether he wants a temple there or not. That's what Muslims teach, is that it's totally up to the Imam Mahdi whether he wants a temple there or not. So even the Muslims are in on this. We believe as Christians that it'll probably be the Antichrist who effects the building of the third temple. From Daniel 9:27, whenever he makes a covenant with many, Revelation 11:12, that the temple and its boundaries are handed over to the Gentiles for a period of 3.5 years. And then in 2 Thessalonians, we can see this as the point, the midpoint, where the Antichrist goes into an existing temple. So 2 Thessalonians 2:4 says, he will oppose and exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, so that he sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God. So we as Christians can see that as the Antichrist affects the building of the temple, and for the first 3.5 years, everything just goes just fine. A lot of the Jews follow him. They see him as the Messiah because he brought back the new temple. Sacrifice is going along great. He has signed a covenant with the people on Temple Mount, so there's peace. Everything is going along great until the midpoint, at which time he stops sacrifice. We see the Antichrist going into the temple, the Holy of Holies, and saying, worship me, I am God. And then that begins the 3.5 year period of the Great Tribulation. And so you see how it all pieces together. All right? Any questions? I know that only opens up a lot more, but I just wanted you to see kind of the different viewpoints, because that little piece of territory is so important. And you got to understand why. Yep. Sir? Does it matter where the temple is built up on Temple Mount? If you look at, there's several different viewpoints of where the temple exactly stood. Most of the scholars believe that it's on the piece of rock that is covered up by the Dome of the Rock. And so that needs to go. There's another viewpoint that, no, the actual temple actually was north of the Dome of the Rock. So there's room for the temple and the Dome of the Rock to stay. There's some really interesting viewpoints about all of this. And, you know, it brings up some fascinating possibilities. So is there room enough for both of them up there? And will this peace treaty, maybe John Kerry will figure it out. I don't know. Yes.
I can see how the, whatever they call that, Mahdi would start that with the temple and
sure.
Everything, because that's going to bring all those Jews in there, and then he's going to be able to think that he can take over the Jews.
She said it makes perfect sense that the Mahdi would do that just to get all the Jews together in one place, make them easier to kill. And Islam teaches that all the Jews will be killed. I mean, that's what the Mahdi will come to do. Great. There's some peaceful coexistence. Anything else? Okay, just for your information, what I want to leave you with is this thought. Because after all that we've studied, after everything that we've looked at, all these details, and if we see what God has done with the land of Israel and the Jewish people for 3,500 years, and I believe with all my heart that he continues to work with him in some matter that is beyond my comprehension, but he's got a covenant that is everlasting, and so he will continue to do that. How it all works out, all the details, I'm not sure. I've got different ideas, but I can't prove them. But I just know that God's got a covenant with them that is everlasting. I also believe with all my heart, no one comes unto the Father except through Jesus Christ the Son. What I see then is, if God is faithful with the land of Israel and its people for 3,500 years, how much more will he be faithful to you because of the blood of his Son? Okay? When you look at the history behind this, you realize how miraculous God is, how faithful he is, how loving he is, what he has done as an example with Israel and the Jewish people to the entire world. And we see that poured out through the love of his son and his blood to bring us eternal life in his presence. So how much more will his faith continue through the blood of his son? So that's what I want you to carry away from this. What I'm going to do is put out on the website this last slide will be part of this. Is here's some of the previous lessons that we've talked about that they're out there. Here's a list of all the books that I've been quoting from. They're great books. I wish some of them are on my Kindle or I'd loan them out, whatever. But they're good books, so that'll be on the website. Also, I have a synopsis of all of the chronology that we've talked about that'll be out on the website also. It's about 6 pages. So it'll be out there so you can print it, whatever you need to do. If you aren't online or if you can't access the website, whatever, and you just want a paper copy, please let me know and I'll make you some paper copies, okay? Because like I say, it's 6 pages, but we can print them front and back. But it's just a bullet all the way through history of exactly what we've been talking about. Any other questions? Thank you all so much. It's like I say, I wanted to finish up in the summer, but if we get on a couple more, but I hope this has helped a whole lot. So let's have a word of prayer. Almighty God, it is so powerful to see how you have been working with a people that you call chosen 3,500 years ago and step through time and see how you're still working with them today, how your faithfulness endures, how your covenants endure. They are everlasting because you are God. We thank you that for the covenant that you have wrought with us through the blood of your Son, that we know, we have assurance that it is everlasting, eternal life with you. We look forward to that time. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank y'all.